This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I don't want to climb a mountain. I don't want to run a marathon. I don't want to be 20 again. Oh, 50 would be nice. I just want to spend the day outside planting tulips with Max.
Tulips with Max. Who wouldn't want to do that? That is a commercial you might have seen a while ago for the blockbuster arthritis drug Vioxx. But in 2004, 5 years after it was approved by the FDA, the pharmaceutical company Merck had to issue a recall for Vioxx due to concerns of increased risk of heart attack and stroke in those using the drug. Now, isn't that something they should have caught when Vioxx underwent its battery of clinical trials? Turns out those trials were funded by Merck, the same company, of course, that developed the drug. A study released this week by Children's Hospital finds that when pharmaceutical firms or other industry players pay for a clinical trial, the results are positive 85% of the time. So joining us is Dr. Florence Bourgeois. She's lead author of this study, as well as an emergency physician at Children's Hospital. She's also an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Bourgeois, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Sasha Pfeiffer, WBUR's health and science reporter. Sasha, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Meghna.
So, Sasha, let me actually start with you. Walk me through exactly what the study found and why it's so important for us to be paying attention to these clinical trials.
So the researchers looked at a federal database of clinical drug trials. They looked at who funded them. Was it a nonprofit? Was it government? Was it industry? And if they were funded by industry, so basically a pharmaceutical company, this is where this dramatic disparity came in. A pharma-funded study would come up with positive results about the drug about 85% of the time versus about 50% of the time for government. They think that's happening because if you pay for a clinical drug trial, you're also probably helping design it, and you can basically design it in ways that kind of get the answers you want.
Dr. Bourgeois, your findings seem to indicate that that happens because the trials are manipulated in certain ways to yield positive results. How is that?
The concern is that our findings may in part be related to biases in the way a trial is designed or the way it's conducted, and also the way the results are reported. But there may be a number of different factors that could be explaining these more positive results. For example, the types of questions that an investigator chooses to ask may impact how well a drug appears to work. And also the design of the trial in terms of which patients are studied and what outcomes are examined, these things will all impact the final result.
How many of the trials out there are funded by the pharmaceutical companies that develop these drugs?
It's certainly a majority, yes.
So this is part and parcel of how drugs make it to the shelves, or I should say pharmacies, in the United States. That's actually quite surprising to me.
Yes, no, it's true. So the information that drives clinical decision-making for clinicians and patients, and also the information on drug labels that consumers look at directly, much of that information does come from pharmaceutical trials that are directly funded by industry.
Dr. Bourgeois, you're basically hinting in this study, or maybe you're just saying it out loud, that there's a fundamental conflict of interest when a pharmaceutical company who's aiming to sell a drug is the exact entity that funds the clinical trial for the drug to receive FDA approval.
That's absolutely true. So in a pharmaceutical company that's designing a trial stands to gain financially by having good results for that medication.
Why is it an accepted practice in the medical world then?
Well, there are certain oversight committees in place and other regulatory factors that try to make these studies as objective as possible. But I think the concern is that we're not catching everything. And despite an increasing movement towards more transparency around how trials are designed, we may not be all the way there yet. Mm.
So on that transparency note, I mean, my understanding was that some, maybe not all, but at least some of these clinical trials end up getting published in some sort of scientific
right.
journal. And those journals, those articles should go through a peer review process of some kind. Shouldn't the peers essentially be seeing the conflict of interest in the design of the trial?
So sometimes the details that are available around the study design are not sufficient to be able to detect that. But some people are calling for study protocols to be actually publicly available as well. And in fact, maybe even having the study protocols undergo some type of peer review process.
Sasha, are there other ways that you've heard or learned about in your reporting of getting the clinical trial process to be more transparent?
Or more rigorous. So now, for example, you might have to, if you want to be in a peer-reviewed medical journal. You might have to enroll your trial. You might have to say it exists. You can't hide it. And you might have to say what the results are. But as Dr. Bourgeois has said, right now there isn't a lot of scrutiny about who funds the study. So that might be the next step. Let's find out who's funding it and make sure that if there is a potential conflict, we know about it in advance.
Are you questioning in any way the scientific rigor of these clinical trials themselves?
Again, we really just don't have that information, and that's not something we looked at. We looked at these results in aggregate and didn't examine any one study in particular. But this overwhelming finding of the association between funding source and the results does call into question whether all these trial designs were as rigorously, let's say, overseen as they should have been.
Mm-hmm. I ask because, you know, we opened the segment with the Vioxx example, a huge story. I mean, it cost Merck many, many millions of dollars to deal with this problem,
right,
let alone the cost to people who were taking Vioxx. But I wonder, because could part of the driving force behind the overwhelmingly positive results that industry-funded clinical trials come out with be that the pharmaceutical companies themselves, they're picking the drugs that are most likely to have a positive outcome because they know them themselves.
Absolutely, and they may be asking the right questions in the right way, and that may be certainly some type of selection bias in which trials to do, which studies to perform may be contributing to this. But without further information, we can't be sure, and the concern is, again, that maybe it's actually a bias in the way the trial is designed and performed, which would be then impacting the scientific evidence guiding clinical practice.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, how worried should people be about this conflict of interest between pharmaceutical companies and the clinical trials for drugs that they themselves produce? Because there aren't a ton of drugs out there that have been approved by the FDA that end up having people be extremely sick or drop dead. I mean, because that would be a terrible outcome, which my guess is no pharmaceutical company would let pass any trial whatsoever.
Right.
So is possibly a bigger concern that due to this conflict of interest, we may be seeing drugs that just actually have the opposite effect, that aren't terribly effective, but the companies want them FDA approved anyway?
Yes, that's a great point. So it's not so much are these drugs harmful, but really how effective are they, and are we spending money on the right drugs? I think that's very, very true. And again, the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, currently does have a very rigorous system in place for overseeing the drug approval process. So for the most part, I think people can certainly feel safe taking medications.
Sasha, in Dr. Bourgeois' study, she mentions this website or this group called clinicaltrials.gov. What exactly is that?
That is a federal registry of clinical trials. So you go online, and it was launched 10, 11 years ago. They were basically trying to say, we want to create a record for all clinical trials. If you do one, we want to know about it. They also, there's a sort of a companion sort of website that's about the results of drug trials, so that if you do a study, you not only know that it happens, but you know what the outcome is. So again, it's an increasing effort to create accountability and transparency.
In the end, Dr. Bourgeois, I mean, I guess the thing that I and maybe listeners are worried about is just this whole idea that there can be such a deep conflict of interest in the fundamental system that drugs go through in order to be approved by the FDA. So is sort of a transparency enough in a system where the pharmaceutical companies are already so heavily involved financially in getting these trials started to begin with?
That's true. Transparency in of itself may not be sufficient. Maybe we actually also need more oversight in the very design of these trials, so that investigators, industry, and other groups who are designing these trials need some review process for the trials and the study protocol when they're evaluating these medications.
Well, that's Dr. Florence Bourgeois. She's an emergency medical physician at Children's Hospital and instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, and lead author of a study that looked into drug trials that were funded by the pharmaceutical industry and which are more likely to publish favorable results. Dr. Bourgeois, thank you so much for being
with
us. Thank you. And Sasha Pfeiffer, WBUR's health and science reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, there's a link to that study on our website, wbur.org/Boston. Well, within an hour, Governor Deval Patrick plans to sign a bill that would change how Massachusetts apportions its electoral college votes. If enough other states pass similar bills, the measure would award all of the Bay State's electors to the winner of the national popular vote. We talked about this last week on Radio Boston, and the topic really riled many of you. Here with an update is our hubbub blogger, WBUR's Andrew Phelps. Hey there, Andrew.
Afternoon, Meghna.
So what are people saying about this plan?
Well, Twitter user John Persky supports the change, but offers this clarification. There are lots of misconceptions. The law will go into effect only when states controlling 270 electoral votes pass the same bill.
Oh, that is true, actually.
Yeah, 270 is the magic number any presidential candidate needs to win. I can still see Tim Russert at that whiteboard in 2000. So far, five other states have signed on to this national compact, and Massachusetts would be the sixth, bringing the total up to 73 electoral votes.
So they've still got a long ways to go, and they lost California. California's not joining this compact. But surely there were people, Andrew, against the plan to upend the Electoral College?
Oh, yeah, if not the majority of our commenters. Listener R.V. Whalen tweets, "I'm against it. It would have meant that in 72, Massachusetts would have voted for Nixon instead of McGovern."
And yeah, speaking of that board, Massachusetts voters seem to pride themselves on that vote when we were, of course, the only state in the union to vote McGovern. So that little splotch of blue in 72.
And it would have meant Massachusetts voted for Bush in 2004 instead of John Kerry. By the way, as you mentioned, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger recently vetoed a similar measure in California for that same kind of reasoning, saying voters there should not lose their voice.
I'm seeing a comment here from Donald Lehman who questions the constitutionality of this measure.
Yeah, Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution prohibits, quote, interstate compacts, he notes, and the precedent here is unclear.
But Andrew, I also understand that some people made alternative suggestions entirely.
Yeah, a popular response was that Massachusetts should follow Maine and distribute electoral votes proportionally, so our electors might be split between two or even three candidates.
I wonder if that's possible given the fact that the governor is going to probably sign this bill soon. But finally, commenter Cume suggests that a reality show called So You Think You Can Be President might be the way to go.
Yes, the commenter writes, they are put through physical and mental challenges like paintball war games and forced to eat bugs and slimy things. They are asked questions to ensure they are smarter than a fifth grader. Comment is brilliant, by the way. It keeps going. Quote, that would be so much more fun and rewarding.
But Andrew, for me, the question is, would Simon Cowell be one of the judges?
Not clear. I think since he was not born in the United States, it doesn't count.
Well, he could be a naturalized citizen and therefore get a chance to vote. But that's all in the future. WBR's Andrew Phelps, our hubbub blogger, sharing what you had to say about a bill that favors the national popular vote in Massachusetts. Governor Deval Patrick, by the way, is signing that bill a little later this afternoon. Andrew, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Meghna. And folks can follow my blog at wbur.org/hubbub and talk to Radio Boston on Twitter at Radio Boston.
And as Andrew said, if you've also got something to say, there's also the website in general for compliments, rants, raves, criticisms, anything at wbur.org/Boston. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.